This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The anti-30-meter telescope protest on Mauna Kea will soon enter its third month. Many of the demonstrators who first assembled at the base of the Mauna Kea access road were students or faculty at the University of Hawaii. The protest began over the summer, but classes are now back in session. We wanted to find out how the university is handling potential absences from the classroom. HPR's Ryan Finnerty spoke with Deborah Halbert. She's the Associate Vice President for Academic Planning and Policy at UH.
Well, we're just reminding faculty about the existing policies and procedures regarding duty date, regarding the courses that they're teaching, regarding making sure that students that are in the classes are having access to the courses that they had signed up for. So we've just tried to remind folks of the existing policies and procedures. There are no new policies and procedures that we've devised for this because, for the most part, I think we have in place the things we need to do to make sure that the start of the school year goes smoothly.
And so what are some of those policies that are in place for an event like this?
Well, so for example, most of our instructional faculty are 9-month employees, which means that they have summers where they are not employed by the university, and we don't see them on campus much, and of course they can go and do whatever they want when they're not employed by the university. But the official duty date began, and that means that faculty do need to be on campus for the different department meetings that they may have scheduled, for orientations, to meet with students. And again, a lot of this is happening at the departmental level. It's not overseen certainly by the University of Hawaii system or the vice chancellors or the chancellors on the campuses, but is really being driven by the departments and what their needs are.
And so for any event, not just specifically Mauna Kea, but if a faculty member needs to or wants to be away, how is that handled?
So we have travel forms. So any faculty who would be traveling for a professional conference or for business related to the university would submit a travel form. That travel form would be approved by their department chair and by the dean of their college. And they would have to give a reason for why they were traveling. They would have to give who's funding the travel in the form. They would have to explain the dates of travel. And all of that is overseen both by the colleges at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. Obviously, at some of the other campuses that are smaller, it would go through a slightly different process. And then it's approved or disapproved based on what is in there. And there's also a lot of oversight to make sure that if you're going for a conference, for example, you're not staying an extra week to do something else unless there's a legitimate professional reason to do so. Faculty also can travel for research purposes, and that may be due to their individual research or a project that they have to do. So faculty are traveling for those purposes as well.
So a conference or something like that is typically a pretty short-term event.
Short.
What's going on Mauna Kea, everybody said it's not going to end anytime soon.
Right.
So how would the university approach a situation where you have a faculty member that's saying, I'm not going to be back for a while, or has that been raised?
So we would have to deal with that on a case-by-case basis. Nobody has said they're not appearing for their duty date, to my knowledge, as of today. And certainly, I think what faculty are trying to do is provide an educational opportunity for students who may want to take classes remotely or have other means of engaging in the academic materials that they're interested in. But the faculty themselves, we've, again, communicated, need to be present for the classes that they have been assigned to teach.
And I know in the memo that went out to faculty, it did mention the remote teaching platform. Could you tell me a little bit about what that is and how it works?
Well, we've been developing since at least the 90s different kinds of distance learning technologies. So we have on campus a HITS program, which allows you to be in a room like this with a television screen and be in another classroom on a different island. So we have those technologies in place. But obviously, online learning in the 21st century is an important component of any higher education landscape. And so we've been embracing and building out online courses for quite a few decades now. And in fact, have just launched a new online associate's degree for returning adults. And so this is part of how we teach these days. And for example, many classes in the summer that we offer are online because both students and faculty are traveling, and it just makes for a more fluid kind of approach to higher education and learning. And interestingly, when we think of our transfer students, many of them coming out of the AA or out of our community colleges, end up transferring to online universities as opposed to some of our 4 years. So we really do need to be building out our online degree opportunities. And so what's happening with the classes that are being offered online for the fall is no different than what, again, we would see happening for any kind of semester. It's just reminding students that they have these as opportunities. And that's really, I think, what faculty, for the most part, have been doing, is saying, look at the classes that we have that you can take and not be present at this particular campus.
Is it possible to have a physical class and then a student who's enrolled in that class that's away, say on Mauna Kea or wherever, to come in remotely? So can you combine those two, or is it all either in person or distance?
It would have to be up to the faculty and their attendance policies and how they're shaping them. Certainly with modern technology, with Skype and BlueJeans and any number of different technologies that allow for you to do hybrid kinds of classes, there are faculty that have been experimenting with those as well. I know the College of Ed has a lot of classes that are hybrid, so students can go via our learning management system and they have a scheduled call and everyone is on there symmetrically. So you'd still be in the class, you just wouldn't be physically in the class. So yeah, those are options too. And again, these are all things that have been in place for years and many faculty have been taking advantage of them and experimenting with different modalities because we try to meet the needs of the students. And lots of students work full-time, lots of students have families, lots of students are trying to commute to the campus, and it takes a long time to do that. And so there's a lot of reasons why they may have difficulty getting to a physical campus. And so really what's happening in this particular situation is no different from what we see happening in any of our other classes where students are trying to get the classes they need to graduate.
And on the student side, if a student is enrolled in a conventional physical class and then decides that they can't be there for some period of time, whether to go to Mauna Kea or for a personal reason. Is there a blanket university policy for how that's handled, or is it done, does each instructor kind of make a decision?
So there's a couple different levels to that answer. One is that for financial aid purposes, faculty need to report when students stop attending class or that students started attending class. And that is obviously so that students can get the financial aid that they had applied for, but if they're not taking a class, then they're not going to get the financial aid for that class. So there's that dimension to it, where students do have to show up and we have to report that for financial aid. But the other piece is that faculty do make their own attendance policies. And so those can be very restrictive. It could be you can miss one class and then your grade goes down, or they can be more flexible. And faculty tend to work with students, especially if students are having family issues or are sick. As a general rule, there's a lot of ways that faculty try to work with students over attendance policies. But it is ultimately the faculty member's decision on how they will enforce the attendance policy. We've encouraged and reminded people that those need to be fair and equitable to all students.
And yeah, and how do you go about ensuring fairness in those policies, since it is being handled by each individual professor?
So as a general rule, the course syllabus will include an attendance policy on it, and then the goal would be to make sure that that attendance policy is enforced, whatever it is that it says.
Is there, specifically with this case of Mauna Kea, it is a very emotional and political issue.
Yeah.
How do you go about ensuring fairness with a highly charged event like that?
Well, I think all of our faculty are professionals. They know how to teach their classes. They know how to engage in difficult conversations and to create a framework in which debate can happen and ideas can be exchanged. And so we rely on them as professionals to do their job.
And so if there's students out there who are trying to find out more as the school year starts, where can they go to get more information?
So I would suggest that for this and any other reason, students should go and talk with their advisors. That's one place to start. They should certainly go and talk to their advisors in their departments. So if they have already declared a major, they should find out what's going on in their department. And then it's really engaging with their individual courses and the faculty members that are teaching those courses.
Okay, great. Debbie, thanks so much for your time today.
Yes, thank you.
That was Deborah Halbert, Associate Vice President for Academic Planning and Policy at the University of Hawaii, talking with HPR's Ryan Finnerty about absences in the classroom. ¶¶
Foodland's Give Aloha program makes it easy to donate to your favorite charity, and it matches your gift. Shop at any Foodland, Sac and Save, and Foodland Farm stores this month and designate Hawaii Public Radio at checkout. Your donation helps to sustain our statewide public service, and along with your groceries, you'll take home our big mahalo.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Up next, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're looking for the name of a kicker currently playing professional football in the NFL. He graduated from Punahou School in 2012, where he was a two-sport star in both football and soccer. After graduating from Punahou, he was accepted into UCLA and made it onto the football team as a kicker during his freshman year. He would go on to receive the Lou Groza Award for the nation's best kicker in his senior year. And in 2015, he kicked a 60-yard field goal against rival school Cal Berkeley, the longest such feat in UCLA and Pac-12 history. And although he went unselected in the 2016 draft, he would go on to sign with the Houston Texans. While his full name includes John Christian, he prefers to go by his Hawaiian name. For today's quiz, can you name this professional footballer? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right. Design Impacts Lives. That's the focus of an event coming up this Saturday in Honolulu at what was formerly known as the Gentry Design Center. Nancy Schnur is with the American Society of Interior Designers. She sat down with us to talk about why design matters and walks us through the process of changing a hindrance into a help.
We impact people's lives all across the board, whether we do residential, remodeling, new build, business offices, healthcare. Everything in space inside our lives.
And our lives matter. And if it's good design.
That makes a big difference. And it kind of crosses the board, too, between comfort, health, safety. You know, all those factors can be affected if the design isn't good.
Now, you folks are going to be covering a couple of things. One is universal design and also aging in place. Mm-hmm. So talk about those issues.
Well, aging in place is obviously a very in the forefront right now on everybody's mind. And it's very important because there will never be enough housing, public or private, for people. So with the aging in place, it's more about making things suitable for seniors with disabilities, vision problems, that sort of thing. Universal design is really about getting building codes and developers, contractors to start just realizing that we need to make things user-friendly for a lot more. Right now, I think it averages like 70% for any given space. Only 70% of the users are comfortable in it.
Mm.
So aging in place, that's more important about where grab bars are placed, and they need the wider doorways for walkers, wheelchairs. But people forget that anybody is really more comfortable. You know, have you ever been carrying a laundry basket through our little 27, 30-inch wide doors and you whack your elbow?
Yes.
Yeah. And think, wow, I wish this doorway was wider.
So just the little things mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. Now, in my household, we had a plumbing emergency, and we ended up having to pull out our kaimuki tub and come up with another design, you know, because the leak was in the wall and it just was a mess. Mm-hmm. But it was those kinds of things. Like, well, you know what? We need a grab bar here. Mm-hmm. And how about a bench?
That's right.
You know?
That's
but,
right.
But those simple things mm-hmm. really does, it makes your life easier.
Well, you know, that's true. When you think about grab bars, and I really hate that there isn't a better name for them, but I do bathrooms now anybody's, whether they ask for it or not. I put blocking in so that if they need one. But we have done bathrooms where we've presented a grab bar to the client that's very attractive. And they start thinking about when they're washing their feet or shaving, whatever they're doing. They're like, no, go ahead and put it in now. That looks nice. And, you know, it's hard for me because everybody has towel bars. Nobody thinks twice about that. But the minute you say grab bar, no, we don't need that, right? But when they look the same, one's just mounted differently, it just takes on a whole new feeling in the bathroom. And everybody's like, yeah, go ahead.
It's funny because my husband and I are thinking, gosh, we should have done this sooner. And it's just those simple fixes, and mm-hmm. it makes a difference.
It does. Lighting's another one that really gets me sometimes in places, especially public restrooms. You know, I know when you're in nightclubs, restaurants, you want ambient lighting and that. But when I get in a bathroom, I want to see what I'm doing. And I've gone in some lately in newer buildings, and it's hard to see in there. If you want to freshen up, find your way. You know, especially now that we're getting into some of the unisex type washrooms, it's really confusing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody from the age of 40 on, our eyes are starting to deteriorate. And there's so many things that can be happening. And it just, there's areas there shouldn't be any leeway for problems.
Right. So if maybe you were into warm lighting, then maybe you should go to cooler lighting because it's brighter, or LED lights or something like that.
Right. And it's also important to have lighting in your own personal space from at least two directions a lot of times. If you get in a space, did you ever, when you were kids, hold the flashlight under your chin?
Yes.
You know? Well, basically, when we mount a light overhead, it does the reverse coming down. And so everybody puts in the regular vanity lights because then it shines out at you. So if you have down lights, because some bathrooms, that's all you can do, you should have a second source of light coming from the side. And it's easier for visibility for people, just like I said, grooming, anything like that. But in like the public restrooms, I think they could have it adjustable, have more than one option for people. But yeah, lighting, and in hallways, as we get older, if you get up in the middle of the night, moving from a very bright spot to a very dark spot can be unsettling. And if somebody with Alzheimer's, it actually scares them. But somebody just with balance problems, it throws them off. So sensored lighting is so simple. You can set it up along pathways. When you walk up stairways, you walk by, the lights come on, you can see where you're walking. It's a low light, both in brightness and in level of near the floor. It makes tripping, you know, you can see everything, and it goes off after you pass.
Yes, and I was in a parking garage recently. I think it's at Ward Village. And they have lights. You open the door, and it goes on. And I thought, how wonderful is this? Because sometimes those stairwells can be a little spooky, you know, in these commercial buildings.
That's
but
right.
This was so nice to be able to, like, oh, I can see. I'm here. You know, and then it goes off.
It goes off when you leave. So we're saving energy. And, you know, it has to be a little more refined for other areas. But that's exactly it. It tends to be reserved for where we need it most. And advocates of universal design say no. It should be everywhere.
Well, having just gone through this emergency plumbing issue and emergency renovation, it's funny because, you know, then you have to make a lot of decisions mm-hmm. when you're switching things out. Mm-hmm. And it's just funny because someone I was talking to was saying, oh, yeah, sometimes, you know, they'll bring a sample of something, a tile or whatever, and, you know, the husband has one idea, the wife has the other idea, and then when they come back a couple weeks later, they've kind of changed places, you know?
Yeah. What marriage counseling, yes. That's usually our minor.
What someone hated, now they love.
Yeah. Well, and that brings up a very good point as to one of the purposes of our event. A lot of people, we still tend to be an enigma for people, and we really shouldn't be. All those decisions were there to guide you through them. And we can narrow down the choices because now there is so much out there to pick from. Between our knowledge of codes, our knowledge of material specifications, and budget scheduling, we work with the client to get that done ahead of time and guide you through when the husband wants one thing and the wife wants the other, and then they switch. And usually you go through a lot, and then they go back to their first choice. But when you're doing it on your own and it's coming to you one item at a time, the end result may not look as cohesive as you thought it did. So our job is to bring it all together in the beginning so we have a bigger vision of all the components. I try to help people pick plumbing where you can set the temperature and leave it, and then you turn it on and off with another knob. That way, every time you get in and out, you just have to turn the water on. You don't have to think about, is it going to be too hot or too cold? Because let me tell you, if you have mobility issues and that water comes out ice cold or hot, you can't go anywhere.
Yeah, that's lots to think about. Uh-huh. You know, that if you get a designer who's used to working with all this stuff, mm-hmm. they can make the process a lot easier.
Right, and most of us are. And another part of our event is speed dating a designer. And I love the name. We're going to have 20 minutes for $20, and you can sit with a designer, and you can bring plans, and you can buy more than one 20-minute increment. But the other side of it is when you want to work with a designer, it's good to have the right fit. And that's true of a number of relationships you have professionally. You want to make sure they understand your vision and you're comfortable asking questions. So it'd be a way to come and really interview a number of designers that are really prominent in the islands right now. And instead of paying for full consultations or trying to schedule them to come to your house, you can come to us and meet 6, 7, 8 designers for a few minutes. Okay. And
kind of like try the dress on, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. This was really interesting.
Oh, good. Good.
Very enlightening.
Thank you.
Nancy Schirner has been talking to us about an upcoming event this weekend. It takes place at Naulama Kukui, formerly known as the Gentry Pacific Design Center. For links, go to our website at hawaiipublicradio.org later today. Now's the time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Reporter Christina Jedra has been tracking the costs of the Kealoha trial involving the former Honolulu police chief, Louis Kealoha, and his deputy prosecutor wife, Catherine. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Gee, I think the headline to your story could be Kealoha Ka-ching.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. So when it comes to the Kealohas, we have criminal cases, we have civil cases, and then there's also civil cases about criminal cases. And all of this adds up to hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions, that taxpayers are really paying in the end. And to try and add up the total, according to one Honolulu lawyer, is really impossible.
Now, I know that just the one lawsuit, I think, that the Kealoha has filed against the Ethics Commission was like almost $700,000.
Right. Yeah, that one case alone, because they sued the Ethics Commission, the former director, and also a former investigator, and that added up to an amount that breaks down to about 70 cents per Oahu resident. And that's just one case that ended up being dismissed. But, you know, with the Kealohas, they just had their trial that ended in June. There's two other trials upcoming, if not more. And then there's all of these civil cases that they filed along the way, in addition to a dispute that was addressed at a city council meeting yesterday. The police commission had approved a taxpayer-funded attorney for Louis Kealoha, and the city disagreed with that. So now we have taxpayers paying for opposing sides of a legal dispute over taxpayer-funded attorneys. So it's just endless, as Ali Silvert described it. He's the public defender for Catherine's uncle, Gerard Puana.
Yeah, it just makes you want to tear your hair out.
Yeah, it's really frustrating for citizens. I've been reading a lot of the comments on these stories, and they're just feeling like enough is enough. Not only have these cases resulted in kind of a loss of faith of city government, but they're also left holding the bag at the end of the day, and they're really tired of it.
Now, I know that there were unusual costs too, because the federal court had to rent out the Blaisdell when they were doing the jury selection for
That's right. A lot of unexpected costs that aren't normally involved in a criminal case. Jurors cost money, renting out the Blaisdell costs money. So all of these things add up, and it's really tough to track because government agencies don't tend to track their billable hours like a private attorney might for a client. So all we can do is kind of guess, and maybe people feel better not even knowing the actual number.
Well, who did you reach out to for reaction to the cost?
Well, I spoke with Ali Silvert, who represented Gerard Puana, and he has been, an observer and involved with this case from the beginning. And he really said that a lot of these costs were unnecessary, that the Kealohas really at any time could have pleaded guilty and saved taxpayers a lot of money. Trials are really expensive. And Mr. Silvert said that, the couple fought him at every step of the way in an earlier civil case. Just every subpoena they fought, and it makes it even more expensive.
Oh, who else did you talk to?
Well, I reached out to Common Cause, Sandy Maas, the director there, and she just said it's really unfortunate that money that could be spent on, social services, addressing Oahu's homeless issue, this is money that instead was spent on these cases. I also reached out to Mayor Kurt Caldwell's office on Tuesday, but I didn't really get a response from him. I heard from his communications director yesterday, and he said the mayor was enjoying time off for his birthday. So we don't really know how he feels about this.
Well, that's funny, because I was just talking to Senator Mazie Hirono, and she said she often needs a Trump-free day. So maybe the mayor needed a Kealoha free day.
Yeah, that's possible. I know he's back on the job today. But he said back in June that after the guilty verdicts came down, that it's time to move on. So I guess that's his stance on the Kealoha issues. But for a lot of citizens, they're not ready to move on, emotionally. And also they're going to keep paying for these cases ongoing. So they're very much still concerned.
Okay, well, the mayor's back on the job today, and a little bird told me that today is your birthday, and you're working.
That is true. I am. Yeah, I'm happy to be here on my birthday answering questions and trying to keep people informed, so thank you.
Okay, we appreciate you tracking all of this, because like we said, Kealoha ka-ching. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Christina Jedra with today's reality check. To read her full story, visit civilbeat.org. On our Hawaii Garden and Forest segment today, we take a closer look at an attempt to offset the carbon emissions linked to our everyday lives. Camilo Mora is passionate about our Earth's health. And this week, the University of Hawaii professor launched a crowdfunding campaign for a very ambitious forest project. His goal is to plant 11,000 trees next month, October 26 to be exact. Last year, he says his team planted a record-setting 1,000 trees in 2 hours. Moro is dreaming big with his carbon-neutral goal to become the first place to offset our carbon footprint by restoring our ecosystem.
We produce on the order of 11 to 15 tons of CO2 per year. It will take us about anything between 5 to 10 trees to offset those emissions. So if we make every person in Hawaii to plant 5 to 10 trees, Hawaii will become the first carbon neutral state in the whole planet. And that's what we want to do, is to create this movement in which people take the social responsibility of cleaning the mess that we are doing. This is not President Trump. This is not China. This is us producing greenhouse gases that we are not removing from the air. The best mechanism that we had in place right now is to plant those trees. And that's what we are doing with this project. Unfortunately, planting trees, amazingly, is a super hard thing to do. It's not only about having the trees, having those seedlings, especially native trees, are super difficult to grow. It takes a lot of time to grow them. We have figured out techniques to be successful at then germinating. Then the issue is planting them and for them to survive after planting. For that, we have developed all kind of technologies from weed mats that reduce the weeds so that you don't have to go and clear after you plant. The trees will survive this fight. And the issue is water. So we had these catchment systems now that you can deploy tree by tree so that you don't have to go and irrigate the tree. The problem that we had in Hawaii is that we had the water that the tree needs. The problem is that it only comes in about 5 days of the year. For the remaining 200 days, 300 days, there is zero water. So this tree had to play miracles for 200 days. So what we are doing is developing a water catchment that catches the water that comes in a few days during the rainy season, and then it gives it to the plant slowly during the dry season. As a result, the tree will have water pretty much every day of the year without you needing to be maintaining this tree. We developed this. Right now, we have every watering system at a cost of about $5 per tree. Our goal has been, again, to make Hawaii carbon neutral. For that, we need to plant 1 million trees a year. And we are not there yet. Right now, for 5 years, we have been planting 100 trees at a time. We planted 1,100 trees in 2 hours last year. Now what we want to do is this October, we want to move to the next step, which is 10,000. If we succeed with this, we want to move to 100,000 for next year, and then hopefully all the way up to 1 million. So
where do we plant all these trees? You had 1,000 last year, and what property was it on?
So this was a property owned by DLNR, by Triple R Hospital. And to be honest with you, the idea of doing this by steps is that you start identifying the problems at every different level. And we have planted very easily 100, even 1,000 trees. But when it came to plant 10,000 trees, of all things that came to be super hard was to find a place to plant them. Everybody is running scared about the idea of planting 10,000 trees. It's breaking my heart just to realize that these people with so much power to make a big difference, and we are running scared of taking this big challenge. You know, we think about planting 10 acres of land as an impossibility. Last month in Maui, we lost 900 acres to a wildfire, right? So when we are losing 900 acres, it's super hard to gain 10. So obviously what we are doing is losing a battle that at the end of the day is going to leave us with an island that is going to be deserted or covered by weeds.
Right, so you take one step forward and 10 steps back.
That's kind of the thing that is heartbreaking, is that if you know the numbers, you realize that 10,000 shouldn't be that hard. And unfortunately, we are making it super hard to plant these 10,000 trees. So to answer your question, right now we just don't have a site. Despite having all of these potential partners that own incredible amount of areas where we can plant the trees, right now we are struggling to convince them to let us plant those trees. So if any of your listeners had 10 acres of land, please let us know. We are kind of in a panic mode to find this place where to plant these trees.
You mentioned that you've been innovative and devised these watering systems. Is that something that is easily, that just anybody can get and make?
That is the part that has taken us the longest time and where most of the development has to happen. We need to become smarter about this, right? One of the reasons why the state and city are so resistant to get this thing moving is the maintenance of these trees after you plant them. And that's an understandable situation. They don't have the people to maintain those trees. So what we have been trying to do is to say, look, we can become smarter about this. You don't have to do any maintenance to that tree after you plant them. How do we do that? Well, identifying what are the problems. So a critical problem are the weeds, right? So now we have these blankets that you put by your tree. As a result, you don't have to go and clear the weeds after you plant, and that's only 70 cents per tree. The second problem is the water. Okay, are we going to send people there every weekend to irrigate this? No, we are not going to do that. We don't have the money to do that. Well, let's develop a device that then captures the water and then it deploys. So you deal with that problem right there. So it has been slowly, but we are getting there. I think that we can become super smart, are planting trees by the millions. if we incorporate a lot of the technology that we had available.
So do you have any of these test systems?
Yes. So right now we had only one, it's what is called a prototype, you know, and I can only afford to deploy one of them. I am paying for this myself. We have been getting some funding from some donors to finance the blankets and a few things here and there. But this development thing is kind of a family endeavor now. So we only had one, unfortunately, that we have been tested at Magoon. And the idea is that now with this campaign that we are creating to plant the 10,000 trees, we get enough money to ensure that every tree will get their own irrigation system. So the university, in collaboration with the U.S. Foundation, is helping us to create this campaign. It went live just yesterday. I think the last time I checked, they were close to $5,000 already donated to do this. So, but again, yeah, the idea is that these devices will be deployed by the volunteers. We have worked very hard to make it super simple for people to deploy this. Even a child of 7 years old can deploy it. And again, what we want to do is to make this so simple that it shouldn't be problematic at all to plant 1 million trees in a year. By the way, people think that I'm crazy when I talk about 10,000 trees, right? You cannot play at that level. Imagine then what they will think at 1 million trees. But what I would like to bring the attention of people to is the fact that in India, they planted 50 million trees in one day. Pakistan got upset with that, and they went and planted 51 million trees the year later. And then Ethiopia got upset, and they went and planted 350 million trees in 12 hours. 350 million trees, and we're thinking that it's impossible to plant 10,000. So, again, this is doable. These countries demonstrated that that's possible. We need to get our act together here. We are the first world. We need to give a better example that this is doable. Again, what we are talking about here is the future of our children. We want our children to look into their future with a forest that they can say, my parents helped make that forest, or they can be looking at a desert and then say, my parents saw this and they did nothing. The difference between those two futures is what we decide to do now.
And so what can we learn from India and, you know, the countries in Africa about what worked for them and how they did it?
We just need to go and do it. We just need to go and do it. President Kennedy said we are going to go to the moon. 8 years later, we were putting the first step on the moon. So any politician here say we are going to be planting all of these trees? Let's get to work on it. Don't make proposals to 2050. You know, by 2050, this guy's already going to be dead. So when are we going to hold these people accountable for the promises that they give to us?
Okay, so you need to be approaching the folks with the big money, the folks that need to do the carbon offsets.
The thing is that we don't even need money for this. You know, like what I'm saying is, let's make this thing so cheap. We are right now at this moment offering everything almost for free. Again, when you start playing this game, you start realizing that people want to be part of it. Just to give you an example, there is a group called the Garden Club of Honolulu. These ladies, I'm telling you, man, I love these ladies. They are like my grandmas, all of them. I just love them. And they say, we are going to help. Now with their support, we are just growing 10,000 trees. They probably thought that was crazy to think about. In 4 months, we propagated 10,000 trees. Right now, we have 100,000 seeds that we collected. So the seeds are there for us to plant now if we want to get to it. But we need to have the government to really help us play, because this resistance to no one to do it, I'm telling you, is going to backfire on us, because later on, it's going to be way too late.
So the next plan, though, is on October 26th, you plan to plant 11,000 trees.
Yes. So everybody who is listening and everybody who has an empathy for the issue of climate change and everybody who wants to leave a legacy behind for our children, please, please, man, I'm telling you, come and give us a hand on October 26.
That was University of Hawaii Geography Professor Camilo Mora talking about his campaign to plant 11,000 koa trees on Saturday, October 26. Willing to help? Mora is also working with the UH Foundation to coordinate donations. For links, head to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Thank you.
in today's Backyard Quiz, we asked our listeners to name a current Native Hawaiian professional football player. Our mystery athlete is a graduate and two sports star of Punahou School, where he was a teammate of current Pro Bowl defensive end DeForest Buckner, before securing a spot on UCLA's roster as the team's kicker. He played all 4 years for the program, where he eventually received the Lou Groza Award for the nation's best kicker his senior year, as well as a consensus All-American selection. In addition to holding the UCLA school record for a field goal with a monstrous 60-yard kick against rival school Cal Berkeley, he also holds a single-season field goal record for the team he currently plays for in the NFL, the Houston Texans. John Christian Fairburn of Kailua is the man's name, but he prefers going by his native Hawaiian name, Ka'imi, which means the seeker. And congratulations to our winner, Jill Park of Kaneohe. She got it right. She says her nephew played soccer with Ka'imi. And that's today's quiz. If you have one, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm John Radcliffe from Capital Consultants of Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
September 17th marks the overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy, and this month, the Hawaii Ponaui Coalition showcases what led up to that event. This Saturday and Sunday, it will offer a free walking tour on the grounds of Iolani Palace. It gives us a glimpse into what happened 4 days before Queen Liliuokalani abdicated her throne to avoid bloodshed, with the hopes that the U.S. would eventually restore the monarchy. It did not. We sat down with Director Sammy Choi to talk about the walking tour, Mai Poina, which means don't forget.
The Mai Poina Overthrow walking tour looks at the 4 days leading up to January 17, 1893, the day of the actual overthrow. We have costumed actors stationed at different places around the palace, around Iolani Palace on the grounds, and the audience actually walks from place to place. So it's not a theater experience where you just sit down and watch. You go to those actors. They're dressed in 1890s costume. And they will tell you what's happening on January 14th, 15th, 16th, what they're upset about, what the Committee of Public Safety has done, what the Queen is intending to do. For instance, January 16th, a woman will tell you that U.S. Marines were just landed and walked down King Street. And she's pointing right at King Street. And she says they're stationed right across the street from us at Arion Hall. And everyone is worried and scared, but we still believe in the Queen. That's the day before the overthrow. And then we get to the 17th, and a woman comes out, a representative of the Queen, and she has to read the statement saying that the Queen has relinquished her throne to the United States. What's interesting and compelling about this is that we all know the outcome. We know what happened in 1893. But when you see actors portraying characters from the period, you get caught up in it. And so by the time you get to the last day, the actual day of the overthrow, you look at the audience's faces and they are dismayed. They've been struck by the disappointment and the anger that all these people have felt. That's theater. That's what theater can do. Make things immediate. Make things hit you in the gut. And the irony, oh my God, the irony is that the Queen is saying, this is what I have done, but now we are trusting in the United States, when presented with the facts, that they will return our kingdom and my throne. She said that. She wrote it. And we know, of course, that it never happened. I honestly think she believed in the United States as a champion of the poor and the weak, and it's so ironic. We have people in Hong Kong now who are waving American flags as they protest for their rights. And, yeah, this show abounds with irony as you go through it.
And we have to mention Mauna Kea because yes. there are folks that are saying this is what it's all about. It's some of that repeated trauma mm-hmm. that we've been subject to
exactly.
over the years.
Yes. On every day of this tour, every station of the tour, there will, I think, be issues brought up that resonate now about the rights of Hawaiians, about the economic coalitions that are trying to grab power for themselves. They talk about voting rights and how voting rights are taken away arbitrarily, like the Bayonet Constitution, what that did. We have a character who's a Chinese man who emigrated to Hawaii mid-1800s, and he says, yeah, under the earlier constitutions, I could vote. But under the Bayonet Constitution, no Asians could vote. And that just resonates about with the racism that's happening today, about voting rights being taken away so sneakily but legally. There's a lot. There's a lot to tweeze apart. There's a lot to pay attention to in this theater piece.
And so when the script was getting put together, you had to do the research and you had to condense it down, right?
The interesting thing is that in 1993, Victoria Nalani Neubel was commissioned to write a 3-day pageant about the overthrow. It was the 100th anniversary. So she wrote that, and it took place downtown in and around. You remember that,
yes,
right?
Yes, I was there for that.
Yes.
Powerful.
Powerful. And there's the queen in a carriage and Marines in costume walking down the street. Victoria took that 3-day show and has condensed it. So all the research comes from primary sources, and we are doing what is essentially a little over an hour's worth of this pageant from 1893.
Is there any chance that some of this could go to the neighbor islands?
We have taken this show to Maui, to the Maui Arts and Cultural Center. We had to revamp it, rework it so that we could do it indoors on a stage. So it's very different, but we use a lot of projections that bring people to locations since we don't have the palace grounds themselves. I would love to take this to Washington.
Now that's an idea.
But funding is always the issue. Funding's always, it's every year. We're struggling for funds.
Okay, but this is how many characters, cast of characters that you've got on this?
In this show, it's 10. We have 10 actors. However, once you finish that tour, you get to January 17th, then you go to the Queen's statue. Euclid Aluli, who is a noted Hawaiian attorney, will be giving you the history of Hawaii from 1893 to now. So you get an overview of what happened. And then after that, we have a group called Pacific Tongues, a slam poetry group. And they perform pieces about their lives now, today. And I've heard that this year, all their pieces are focusing on the Mauna, on TMT. So that should be really riveting.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So, yeah, a way to be able to weave the past and the present.
Exactly. And then after that, we do have Hawaiian scholars on hand to give people a forum to vent, to say how they feel about what they've seen, to ask questions, too, if there's something they didn't understand or something they've never heard of. Our Hawaiian scholars are there to answer them.
Okay, so putting it all in context, mm-hmm. We're going to be in the Capitol District, just yep. across from Kauai Hau Church, which is marking the arrival of the missionaries, the 200th anniversary, big deal.
Lots
of context, lots of history to kind of digest and mm-hmm. process mm-hmm. to help us understand just what are the forces at play today.
Right, and by listening to what happened then, you understand what's happening now. And because this is such an important message, the foundation has made it free every year. You still have to get reservations at maipuina.org, but it is absolutely free.
That was Sammy Choi, director of the walking tour and dramatization of the events leading up to the overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy. The final tours, again, are Saturday and Sunday afternoon. The program is free. Reservations recommended. For links, go to our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
My name is Chris Friendrice. I'm the Director of Operations for Veterinary Emergency and Referral Center of Hawaii. Our favorite thing about being an underwriter for HPR is definitely the feeling that we are giving back to the community. In general, that's something that our business tries to do on a regular basis. Hawaii Public Radio, being something that we all listen to personally, was a natural choice for us to support that and give back.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here.
That wraps it up for today. Up tomorrow, well, we invited Hawaiian Electric Company to take your questions about everything under the sun, its ambitious green energy plans, and its request to hike your rates. How is your power bill? What do you think? Call our talkback line. Leave us some feedback or join us live. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for The Conversation.